Welcome to New Books Network and our show, New Books in Law. I'm your host, Catherine Hermes, from Central Connecticut State University. And we're talking today with Doron S. Benatar, a professor of history at Fordham University, and the author of Trade Secrets, Intellectual Piracy and the Origins of American Industrial Power, and Richard D. Brown, Board of Trustees, Distinguished Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Connecticut, and co-author of The Hanging of Ephraim Wheeler, A Story of Rape, Incest, and Justice in Early America. Their co-authored book, Taming Lust, Crimes Against Nature in the Early Republic, was just published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2014. Welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This book is a really interesting combination of a history of law, a history of politics, history of social mores, and religion. In the book, two men in the late 18th century are accused of crimes against nature. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit how you came upon these cases and how you decided to write a book about these two unusual individuals and their situations.
Well, this is Dick Brown, and I can easily tell you how I came upon the case of John Farrell, the Massachusetts elderly man in his mid-80s who was accused of having sex with a dog in 1796. When my wife and I were working on The Hanging of Ephraim Wheeler, there was an effort to pardon Wheeler after he was convicted for committing rape, incest. And in order to place that pardoning effort in context, we went through every pardoning effort in Massachusetts between 1780 and 1820. And in the process of examining those pardoning efforts, we came across the effort to obtain a pardon for John Farrell after his conviction. And that led me into the case, but I set the case aside for some time, and Doron will give you the next piece of it.
I came to it quite intentionally. What happened was that I finished working on Trade Secrets, and I finished working on another book, and I was, at that time, I was studying psychoanalysis, and I was looking for something that will combine my interest in early America and sexuality, and there is a famous article by John Merrin on bestiality in colonial America, and at the end of the essay, Merrin mentioned some, you know, the case of Gideon Washburn, said, oh, something, you know, and dismissed it with a sentence or so. And so I decided to see what I could find then. So I went to Litchfield, and from there I through some luck I found some documents and some things that were shed some light on the case. And I called John Merrin, who was teaching at Princeton at the time, and I said to John Merrin about it, and I said, and he said, well, you should contact Dick Brown because he has another case that's similar. So Dick and I talked on the phone, and the first thing we decided to do a joint panel together at the annual meeting of Society of Historians of the Early Republic. It was quite appropriate because it was the meeting in which Dick was named president of the society. So it was an omen for his presidency that, if you wish, that we did that, and we did that in a couple of other things. And the time came for us to decide what to do. Each case on its own, the evidence is not sufficient. You know, it's too, you know, those are very obscure cases, difficult evidence. Difficult to find evidence. Each case on its own does not really measure up to a book. The two of them together are more than an article. And so we sat at UConn, Dick and I, and we discussed it, and we decided to try to write a book about it. And we did.
The first question that we needed to addressed together before deciding to go forward was whether this was just a quirk, an oddity of no larger significance, that one case in Litchfield in 1799, another case in Hampshire County, Leverett, Massachusetts, 1796, whether there was any reason why we should put these two together and seek any larger generalizations, or whether this was just a random cluster. And we pondered that pretty substantially, and we looked as far as we could in the records of the early Republic to see whether there were any other cases, and we found that these seemed to be, we can't say absolutely with certainty that these are the only two cases, but these are the only two cases we can say with confidence where men in their 80s were not only accused, but tried, convicted, and sentenced to hang. And this happening all within the space of a few years in two locations within 70 miles of each other. And that seemed to us to indicate that if we investigated it, we might indeed find that there was something going on in the society that led the authorities to take seriously the accusations of bestiality, and led the authorities then to pursue these cases to the fullest extent of the law, up to and including the sentence of death. And to have this happen after the American Revolution, after penal reform was sweeping across the new United States, after the death penalty was being rolled back in state after state, to have these two states, Connecticut and Massachusetts, go ahead with this really antiquated law and penal arrangement seemed to us to be worthy of serious investigation.
It's really striking, you know, again, that why do you try? I mean, it's, you know, one of the first questions that this brings to mind, the first questions that we ask is, why are these cases brought to trial?
Mm-hmm.
There are cases which society must, you know, try: murder, robbery,
right?
Violence, you know, public violence. Even though rape, you know, rape is not, is very frequently not tried, but it's from different reasons altogether. But the crime of sex with animals is particularly, it's odious in every society. It's always a taboo. It's something that that either disgusting or funny, probably both. So why?
Yes, Stephen Colbert treated it in a very amusing way in the last 10 days.
Right, with that Cochran, who
the Mississippi senator who, in seeking to ingratiate himself with a Mississippi audience, remarked on how he had engaged in indecent actions with farmyard animals when he was young.
Right, and he won. So clearly there was a constituency there.
This was one of the funniest footnotes I've ever read, and I actually went to look up the article online.
Yes, so the key is, you know, these kind of things happen, you know. It turns out, and, you know, here I was, I must admit, quite naive with all my kind of mumbo-jumbo psychoanalysis. I initially thought that bestiality is very much like cannibalism, in which, you know, cannibalism is something that people always accuse their enemies. But the real documented of dietary cannibalism is very rare. And that's what I thought about bestiality. I thought it was like witchcraft. It's not. Every society has some segment of its population, almost always male, who are engaged in this kind of, let's call it, unsavory activity.
Well, right. And what we found from the literature around the world, from Europe, from North America particularly, is that it's not such a terribly rare behavior. Among males between the ages of 15 and 30, there's a significant fraction in the U.S. historically and in the present in Europe, who engage in this experimentally, maybe not as a lifelong practice, but in general, we found that in colonial America, it was overlooked. It wasn't attended seriously. We did find a number of prosecutions for it, but chiefly we found occasions where males between the ages of 15 and 30 were accused. A prosecution might be begun, but not finished. We did, of course, find, as Morin had discussed, cases in 17th century Puritan New England where bestiality and other sexual crimes were very severely punished, including execution. But in New England, at least, after 1700, as with witchcraft, it's no longer a crime that's pursued by the authorities. And we did find a case in New Jersey in the 1750s, and another case, interestingly, in Pennsylvania in the 1780s. And the Pennsylvania case ended in execution, but the very next year, the backlash against such a grave punishment led to Pennsylvania removing the crime of bestiality from the capital list. So it was no longer a capital crime there. And that indeed is the policy of all of the states south and west of New England. They all remove bestiality, which was a crime in the English penal system up into the 19th century. Indeed, in England, the last man was executed for bestiality in 1831.
I actually wanted to ask you a little bit about England, because you do go into the history in Europe. You mentioned in Sweden, there were hundreds of people executed in the 17th century. In your discussion of England, you bring up something that almost, for lack of a better word, this is my word, not yours, but is almost a pogrom against sodomites.
Right.
And I wonder if you could explain what's going on in England and what the relationship is between sodomy and bestiality in the minds of the public.
So, I think that what you're referring to is the very striking and shocking for us, the discovery of the number of men executed in England for so-called sodomy. And the most striking of all statistics for me is that in 1806, more men were executed for sodomy than for murder in England. The English, indeed, were very harsh on sodomy, but they were not particularly harsh on bestiality, where in Sweden it's the opposite. That's one of the most interesting things, and how you have Sweden and Norway. In Sweden, it's bestiality, and in Norway, it could be sodomy. Spain and Portugal. In England, in the United States, we have bestiality trials, but we really don't have sodomy trials. What it is about certain societies, they turn them towards policing this form of sexuality or that form of sexuality. Sexuality is always transgressive, particularly non-conventional sexuality. It's always calls for, in times of anxiety, to disciplining. You know, who can forget the 2004 elections in the United States, where George W. Bush was running for office, and the strike of genius by Karl Rove to make gay marriage the real litmus test of how where you stand, and suddenly it was not about Iraq, and it was not like that, and so we have this kind of things is quite common in every society. Now with England, what we see, and this on that I must first of all acknowledge that we are relying on the scholarships of others.
Right.
Our specialty is in America. But from the reading of other scholars, there are many, many fine scholars of English history of homosexuality in England, what we see is that in times of political crisis, that the English state seems to sort of harden its treatment of transgressive sexuality, and becomes associated with political transgression. So at the time of the Wars of the French Revolution, which is really what we're talking about, and this, of course, has an impact on the situation in North America, at that time, in many ways, the American repression of the Federalists, the Alien Sedition Acts, and the entire sort of, you know, it's not only late 1790s, but from 1793 onwards, there's like real anxiety over the kind of the coming of the end of the world because of the French Revolution, is very much, it has some dimensions that are reminiscent of England and some that are not. And so the sexual dimension, interestingly enough, is that the manifestation in England is towards homosexual men, whereas what we discover is this kind of, in the backwater of New England, in the New England interior, that these anxieties that are sort of going to be expressed through hostility towards different sexualities is directed at these two men in their 80s. How many men in their 80s do you think lived in the 1790s in New England to find them?
It's a vanishingly small fraction of the whole population makes it past 75. So, you know, and more broadly, there is a kind of ideology of respect for elderly men. And it is perhaps partly for that reason that both Washburn and Farrell may become targets, because the respect that is expected to be accorded to elderly men is dependent also on their proper behavior. They are to behave in a patriarchal way, to be models of probity, of propriety, certainly not to manifest sexual deviance. So it may be precisely because they are what you might call deviant patriarchs that the authorities come down so hard on them. But I would again return to the theme that Daron emphasized, having to do with the 1790s, the panic over anti-Christian behavior, over the French Revolution's unsettling dimensions, because we did find John Adams in the 1760s and 70s in his diary speaking in a rather jocular way about bestiality. He tells a joke. He records a joke in his diary that his father told in 1761. It's not especially funny, but it turns on bestiality.
John Adams was not known for being a fun guy.
Well, it was a good story, though.
Not known by some, but
yeah.
Anyway, and the other story that he tells from the 1770s, not bestiality, but sodomy related, is of a respected deacon in the town, an older man in his 60s or 70s, who's going around sleeping with various boys in the town. And people are remarking on it, and they're joking about it, and the authorities are not prosecuting it. Nobody is getting unduly upset about it. So what happens in Leverett, Massachusetts in 1796, in Litchfield, Connecticut, in 1799, is certainly significant. And another point that Daron may want to elaborate is that these cases in these small communities, I would say, inevitably have a personal dimension to them. And both Washburn and Farrell were, in their different ways, pretty marginal. And vulnerable.
Farrell was Irish, as I recall.
Farrell is Irish, yes. Though I would be careful not to make too much of that, in the sense of looking backward through the lens of anti-Irish sentiments of the 1820s, 30s, and 40s. In the 1790s, and this is a subject into which I've looked with some seriousness, Americans, New Englanders included, did not especially make a distinction between Protestant Irish and Catholic Irish. They regarded them all as Irishmen, North and South, and they regarded them as a little bit wild, but they were not unwelcome in New England. There were quite a few of them in New England. I would mention that the prosecutor in John Farrell's case was James Sullivan, who was the Attorney General of Massachusetts. Many people think that Sullivan is actually an Irish name. And in fact, Sullivan's father had come from Ireland. His father had been Catholic, but James Sullivan was brought up as a Protestant. And he became the governor of Massachusetts. He was the leader of the Jeffersonian party in Massachusetts in the early 19th century. So I wouldn't overemphasize the Catholic or the Irish dimension of Farrell's situation. What his religion is, I don't know. That is not information that was in any way available.
You did bring up in your book about the men, the Unity men who were expelled from Ireland. You did discuss that a little bit, but you had no evidence that Farrell was one of these or...
I would actually say that the evidence is contrary because he had come to the United States. I don't know exactly when he came to the United States, but he began to practice medicine, or put it a different way. I have found advertisements of his for his medical treatments dating from the 1780s. So that's before the great disturbances of Ireland and the coming of the French in 1798 and so on, where, you know, the Irish are very much associated with the French Revolution.
So he's kind of an old-timer in America, from what you can tell.
And he is an old-timer, but here's one of the interesting things about Farrell's situation. He's peripatetic. He doesn't come to any specific location and settle there. He is a cancer doctor, which is not a university-trained or elite kind of physician. It's kind of a, in some ways, a self-taught or apprentice type of physician that he is. And cancer doctors get the cases that more recognized doctors give up on. They can't treat them, so, well, okay, nothing is to be lost by going to a cancer doctor or having a cancer doctor come to you. And Farrell practiced in a variety of locations that we found in New York State, Connecticut, and in Massachusetts from the 1780s on into the 90s. He had people who gave him substantial testimonials for the excellence of his treatment. These included clergymen, Yale graduates, Harvard graduates. So he's in a kind of marginal place, and he had practiced in Boylston in Worcester County for several years prior to coming to Leverett, and he was in Leverett for only approximately 8 to 10 weeks before he was accused. So he's very much at the margin of the Leverett community. And in his trial, he explains, I shouldn't say in his trial, in his petition letter to the governor, he explains that he's friendless, that he has no friends in the community who can vouch for his moral stature.
And Gideon Washburn was a different case altogether. He was from Connecticut, born in Oxford, I think.
Yeah.
And in Derby.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And
Oxford is a parent, Oxford is part of Derby, right? Yeah.
And so he's from an old, relatively old family. They move into the Northfield.
It's a 1630s family. It's as old as Connecticut gets.
Right. It's an old Connecticut family. He has, his grandfather is one of the founders of the town. His father is one of the leaders of the town, of Derby. His family keeps him, has some, continues to have some influence in Derby, but he is not the wonder boy of the Washburn's family, and he would be he could be described as somebody whose lifetime trajectory is downward. It's one of those stories that we don't tell often enough as American historians, the downward trajectory. We are inundated with stories of, poverty to wealth, but there are quite a few people who are born to upstanding families, and some of the Washburn family continue to do well. In fact, they had a Washburn Tavern. And the building of the Washburn Tavern still stands in present-day Oxford, Connecticut, in 2014. He, on the other hand, lives on the margins. He becomes involved with counterfeiting ring apparently so poor that they don't even do much in terms of punishment because nobody could be fooled by it. By the low quality of his crime, of his criminal activity, he joins the military a couple of times. Goes to war.
He's literate.
He's Episcopalian. So to talk about religion, one thing you think about him is that to be Episcopalian in 18th century Derby says something. Says something. You're not part of the congregational elite, and he is supposedly, according to law, to sort of town lore, he was a great hunter, and he was friends with the Indian chief. There's still Indians living in Connecticut in the 18th century.
Still Indians in Connecticut in the 21st century.
That's right. I can't believe it. Yes, that's true. And they, but I think that the. I meant in a different kind of way.
And not on reservations, necessarily.
Not on reservations. They live part of the town. And he goes from, it gets worse for him. And eventually, his youngest son moves to New Milford, which is, up in the hills of Northwest Connecticut, and they lived there for a while. And in the 1780s, his youngest son, who his name is William, that's Gideon Warden, gets married and moves to Northfield. He moves to Northfield. Northfield is like a little village that is part of the town of Litchfield. Now, Litchfield is cosmopolitan, whatever that means, for 18th century interior New England. But it's kind of a county seat. It's got the law school. It's got some intelligentsia. It's got U.S. senators. It's got the very important female academy. But Northfield is, where the...
It's a hamlet.
It's a hamlet down the hill. And it's really, to go up that hill, which you have to go... And there's all these sort of, Americans, you'll be familiar with sort of the tensions between towns in the peripheries and the center of town and conflicts over who will pay for this and who will pay for guard duty and who will pay for roads and the church. And so they settle in Northfield. And they live there for some time. I mean, they live there for over a decade before these kind of accusations come. And the interesting thing about the accusation against Gideon Washburn is that unlike Farrell, he's there 6 to 8. How long is there?
About 8 to 10 weeks.
8 to 10 weeks, and the accusations emerge. With the case of Washburn, when the charges are finally filed, they are filed and they sort of charge that he engaged in sex with animals six different times over a period of 3 years. Which again brings us to the first question, you know, 3 years. What have you, you know, why suddenly, why is the sixth time, why is the sixth cow so special?
Right.
Know, it needs protection. I mean, what about the first cow? You know, so the, it comes to the question, why do you bring charges against a person for something that, if you know, supposedly he was had been doing for 3 years already?
And these are all with different animals.
With different animals, according to what we know, though. So there's something about the charge, the charge that it's kind of odd because it says, you know, that almost five of the accusations happened on the first of the month, you know, on the first of the month. So I'm not exactly sure, you know, it seems to me like it says, remember, you know, I think it was in August 1797, sorry, so first of August, they called it. Mm. But again, so why? Why exactly do you charge this this kind of pathetic old man who's not threatening anybody? You know, why do you not dismiss it the way John Adams dismissed it? The way communities did. I mean, in the 1770s, a New Hampshire farmer got drunk on the Boston Common and had sex with his mare there. Lots of witnesses. What happened to him? He was tried and convicted of attempted buggery. Rather than execute him. I mean, that's really kind of, you know, it was kind of, and he was, there was a handbill that was published about it, sort of, it's kind of it's a humorous thing. That's the way society handles this. I mean, that's how we handle this kind of, why suddenly
yeah,
you execute?
That's the other piece of this, that is that it's not at all uncommon in the 18th century or the 19th to have some variant of jury nullification whereby whatever the indictment may be for, however grave the punishment that would follow from the indictment, the jury finds something different. And instead of being actual rape, they say attempted rape or lewd and lascivious conduct. Instead of bestiality, they can say attempted bestiality. And, I mean, when it comes right down to it, proving the fact of penetration and emission is pretty difficult. It's a question as to whether an eyewitness can truthfully testify to all of those facts.
And so here we are in late 18th century Western New England, so Western Southern New England. There's an evangelicalism, a new evangelicalism that's starting to break out. In addition, there are two very extreme rival political parties, the Federalists and the Jeffersonian Republicans. How did these cases fit into that?
Well, it's our conviction that because of the whole array of political and religious circumstances, the elite of both states, of Connecticut and Massachusetts, at least a portion of the elite panicked. They were worried about irreligion. They were worried about the Bavarian Illuminati, you know, a secret society that was against Christianity. They were worried about French democracy, Marbocracy, Jacobins, as they called their opponents. And under these circumstances, they were very fearful of maintaining order within their own two states. And the Federalists did not have a firm grip on either of the two states politically. In both states, there was an active, vigorous Jeffersonian party. And so it's our contention that the people who were in charge made the judgment that we must enforce the law. We must enforce the law. The only arc of safety in this welter of political confusion, religious confusion, is to enforce the law. And so when common farmers, neighbors of these people, brought charges, they found it difficult to just sweep them under the rug or push them aside. And so they took them seriously. And once in the judicial system, once it entered the legal system, there was a kind of inexorability about trial, evidence, argument, and then it was up to the two juries. And while both men, both Washburn and Farrell, had excellent legal defense, they also faced very serious prosecution. And the juries in both cases sided with the witnesses, who were, after all, people of their locale, respected voters, farmers, chiefly farmers, property owners. And if the witnesses swore that X, Y, and Z were true, it was hard to dismiss that. And so there were convictions. And then some difficult controversies developed, because both in Connecticut and Massachusetts, the idea that you would just go ahead forward without hesitating and reconsidering and executing was not the case. The people in Massachusetts and Connecticut knew Beccaria and the penal reforms that were going on elsewhere. In Connecticut, Beccaria's treatise on crimes and punishments, including his section on crimes difficult of proof, which covered sodomy, had been printed in New Haven newspaper in the 1780s. They knew about this. The defense attorney, the chief defense attorney for John Farrell in Massachusetts, was Caleb Strong. He came back to Massachusetts, and the first case that he tried after returning from Philadelphia, where he had been one of Massachusetts' two United States senators, was the Farrell case. And Strong knew very well that in Pennsylvania, they were at the threshold of abolishing the death penalty except for treason and murder, and had, in fact, before he left Pennsylvania, abolished it except for those two crimes. So, and he was also conscious that Massachusetts had a reputation for hanging Quakers, for hanging witches, that Massachusetts had a problematic reputation when it came to severe punishments. So the elite in Massachusetts was, on the one hand, some of them were panicked about the onset of Jeffersonian radicals and Thomas Paine's deism and the spread of irreligion, but there were also many who understood that simply executing two men, or in each case in their state, one man for this crime would not be well regarded outside of their states, elsewhere in the United States, and would be a blot on Enlightenment Massachusetts and Enlightenment Connecticut. And you could talk about Connecticut's response a little bit.
Yes.
Well, you know, the challenges that historians face is always connecting the dots between sort of the broader social, cultural, political developments and individual cases. So what we found in the cases, particularly in the Connecticut case, is that there is an imperfect lining up of political figures and religious figures in the Washburn case. Particularly, it seems to be, but it's not uniformly, it seems to be that the people who prosecuted Washburn were the were for the most part Federalists who were anxious, as Dick pointed out, over the you know, the world coming apart. I mean, you know, the resorting to the law is sort of to the law is the only thing left. And if you think that the world is really collapsing, and
that everyone agrees that the law has legitimacy,
right? So what you have in the case of Farrell and Washburn, you have really offenses that exist in the book, and suddenly they become a real case, and that they need to be prosecuted. And to the full extent of the law, because we're going to assert that our society is orderly, that the kind of the fantasies of a grand conspiracy that Dick mentioned is not, we're not going to let it, I mean, happen in our midst. We certainly will not allow this kind of wild sexuality to emerge, you know, again, it makes all the more interesting why they choose these two old men, because there's not exactly a plague of old men doing animals in the fields of southern New England. I mean, this is not, if you're looking for to make an example of somebody, get a couple of teenagers. But they don't. They choose these two men. For you asked about relationship between sort of the religious and political dimension. So I'll give you a couple of examples, but there are many more. One is that the person who defends Gideon Washburn is Pierpont Edwards. Pierpont Edwards lives in New Haven. He is one of the sons of the great Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards from, you know, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God and other such famous tunes. He is the opposite of his dad. He is very much like his nephew, Aaron Burr, committed to the life of pleasure. He's also associated with a particular famous case of impregnating a woman who then dies in a tavern, giving birth in a tavern in Massachusetts, which becomes the plot for one of the more popular sentimental novels of the period called The Coquette. And the character of the coquette, the vile seducer, is considered to be Pierpont Edwards. Edwards is the head of the Republicans in Connecticut. He never really goes to Litchfield for patrol. He doesn't appear in Litchfield courts in other cases. He goes there to defend Washburn. Well, exactly why? What exactly is his interest in going there? And the answer is that Washburn's son, William, seems to be, not like Edwards, a Freemason, and that Edwards understands the challenge, the case against Gideon Washburn as a case as associating their Republicans, the Jeffersonians, with kind of degenerate sexual corruption. So you have this, and on the other hand of Edwards, there's a guy named Uriah Tracy, who is the lead prosecutor, and he is the Federalist senator, United States senator from the state of Connecticut. Now, think about it. Why would these two highly distinguished public figures stick their nose in such an odious affair?
That was something that was striking to me as I was reading the book, like just how many famous people got involved in the lives of these two seemingly obscure men.
Right. And why? And why exactly would they care so much about it?
I think the answer is these are capital cases.
Right.
And we may not appreciate it fully from this distance, but it certainly is my sense that people, certainly in New England and perhaps all over the United States at the time, took capital cases very, very, very seriously. They were tried by the highest courts, and the best talent was typically engaged on both sides of the contest. That's not true in many lesser kinds of cases where the consequences are much smaller, but for capital cases, this is what I've seen.
In the next level, on the religious dimension, I mean, we are seeing the emergence of a kind of a revival in New England, led by Yale President Timothy Dwight, who is a grandchild of Jonathan Edwards. It's all in the, you know, within the Edwards family,
right?
You know,
right.
You know, and Timothy Dwight had the opposite lesson. He learned the opposite lesson than Pierpont Edwards or Aaron Burr, another grandchild of Jonathan Edwards. He comes to Yale actually to clean house, because Yale was run by this guy named Ezra Stiles, who believed in enlightenment and all this other stuff. No good. The students of Yale, didn't come to church on Sunday. They would read, you know, Thomas Paine. So he comes and he cleans house, and he has all these young men that he trains, and he sends them all across New England, and they generate revivals. And a year before the Washburn trial, the Litchfield Church hires a new minister, Dan Huntington. And Mr. Huntington brings revival to Litchfield.
Huntington is an Edwards acolyte.
Right. And he generates great deal of hostility within the community. The Jeffersonians feel alienated by him because he sides openly with the Federalists. And he charges one of the most important Jeffersonians in the city of the town of Litchfield, Ephraim Kirby, who would later be sent by Jefferson to Louisiana. And Ephraim Kirby is also the author of the first collected cases in American history. So he's a man of, you know, if you study legal history in America, well, American law, he's an important figure. He charges him that he is infidelity. In other words, that he doesn't, that he's an atheist. And, you know, in our mind, you know, being called this kind of name, you know. But Kirby is terribly offended by that. And this kind of scandal over do you really believe in God or not reverberates throughout the nation. This is not only a New England thing, but in the context of Litchfield and the tension and the anxieties that are brought about by the world seems to be collapsing, you know, and then the French are going to come and they're going to invade, and who knows, they'll, you know, rape our women and sell our children to slavery. In this context, this becomes very explosive. And so Huntington comes into a community that's very much, in, you know, experiencing strife, and he just pours gasoline. And part of the story is that the trial, the Washburn trial, is part of this gasoline, but it's not the only one. I want to just mention that this kind of resort to the Puritan justice, you know, it's not only with Washburn. That, you know, before Washburn, there's a guy by the name of Clark who's tried for bigamy, and
this is in the same court session where Washburn will be tried. Before Washburn is tried,
right.
This other case.
There are two cases: one for a rape by Phoebe Thompson, and the other by a she's actually exonerated from no, she no, she was charged for no, she was exonerated because she was raped, and not, you know, I think it was what was the charge? I forget the.
I don't remember.
Right. So you got two old historians.
I have to look it up.
No, I have to look it up. That's right. But Clark, the punishment that he gets is he gets whipped and he gets branded with letter A for adultery. And that's completely a 17th century pure injustice. I mean, what we're seeing here is, in this moment of great anxieties, these elite is resorting to some Puritan justice that they sort of imagined would restore order. And I think what it gives us a sense about the anxiety that these people felt. That this is not something that they did lightly. They felt the world is collapsing. They saw all the things they believed in endangered, politically, religiously, culturally, the behavior of women who start to challenge, kind of modes of feminine behavior, and they resort by that we are going to stop. This is the law. This is the foundation of our society, and the law must be upheld.
I would add, we didn't have good statistics on this for Connecticut, but we did for Massachusetts, and what we learned in Massachusetts was that prosecutions for sexual misbehavior of any sort essentially died out in eastern Massachusetts after the Revolution. They stopped prosecuting adultery, lewd and lascivious conduct.
Fornication.
Yeah. Tremendous sexual morality broke out in eastern Massachusetts and bypassed western Massachusetts.
Or else.
But it seems really that the Easterners are more cosmopolitan and they're more in tune with the ways of the commercial and transatlantic world, and they've given up on worrying about these things in courts. But not so from Worcester County west through Berkshire County. Worcester, Hampshire, and Berkshire County see a continuation of prosecutions for adultery, fornication, as well as rape. And I should back a little bit. Rape is prosecuted in eastern Massachusetts, but rape is really a different crime. Rape is a crime of violence. It's a coercion. And they take rape very, very seriously. They will execute people for rape in many states, including in New England.
Yeah, but consensual things that he used to prosecute for fornication and other stuff, that is true in eastern Massachusetts. But interestingly, in western Massachusetts, it remains, which suggests again that there's this residue of Puritan morality that still holds. And when
and it's Second Great Awakening country,
right? It's Second Awakening, and when the sort of wolves are at the door, suddenly what are we going to defend ourselves with, if not what we actually stand for? What do we stand for? For the people of Western Massachusetts and Northwest New England, what do we stand for these cosmopolitan corrupt places, for Mobocracy, it's associated with the guillotine, with French aggression, we stand for virtue and true values and loyalty to the legacy of our forefathers, who in the name of just religion, crossed the Atlantic and built those colonies.
Both Leverett, Massachusetts, and Northfield, Connecticut, lie just outside of smaller cities. Like Litchfield, as you mentioned, it had the law school, it had the Sarah Pierce Academy. There were people who came from Yale to study with Tapping Reeve. Northampton had been the seat of Jonathan Edwards. It had famous ministers. It had,
Caleb Strong.
Caleb Strong.
Joseph Wally.
Just educated people. They had newspapers and correspondence. And yet these two kind of peripheral towns generate these controversies, and it really does show the tension in the local areas.
Right. And so you add to the kind of big tensions, the global tension, the cultural tension, those local tensions that really are built into this. Though I think that in the case of Northfield versus Litchfield, I think the evidence more is pronounced because Leverett is an independent town, but Northfield is not. And the interesting thing is that William Washburn, the son of Gideon Washburn, is a prominent figure in all sorts of moves done by Northfield to separate itself from Litchfield, to have an independent church, Episcopalian, to build a road and to create a community there that's independent of downtown. And that is a threat to downtown Litchfield. So on some level, William Washburn is not, you know, he himself is not a big enough figure to be threatening anybody. I mean, he is the sixth richest man in Northfield. But it's like being the sixth most famous person in a little village. I mean, you know, out of 30 people, he's the sixth richest, right. You know. Nothing in comparison to the wealth. And I mean, there's real aristocratic families living in Litchfield. I mean, the Walcotts, the Frederick Walcott Sr., who was governor of Connecticut, and then Oliver Walcott Sr., and Frederick Walcott will be, he's the one son, and then Oliver Walcott Jr., who will serve as a secretary of the treasury in the Adams administration, and then afterwards will be the governor of Connecticut. And the list of Tapping Reef, the only law school in America.
The Talmadges.
It goes on and on. Yeah, Talmadges.
There are some interesting things that I wish I could have untangled, but this conversation provokes. The justice of the peace to whom the charges against Farrell were brought was Simeon Strong of the town of Amherst, just at the boundary of Leverett and also abutting Northampton. And Simeon Strong was an older man. He was soon to be appointed to the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts. So he's a person of estimable stature, but he's always lived in the locale where he's living in Amherst. He's no cosmopolitan. And I've often wondered, suppose Simeon Strong had responded to these charges by saying, well, come back in a month and tell me about it, or we'll look into it. I'll conduct my own investigation into it and get back to you. Or some stalling tactic, whether he could have prevented this whole case from going forward. I suspect that he could have retarded the case, whether he could have blocked it if the witnesses were really bound and determined to prosecute Farrell, I doubt. But interestingly, his, I believe it's second cousin, Caleb Strong of Northampton, will make a very strenuous effort to save John Farrell. So it's a kind of an irony of people within the same family of Strongs, one of whom is very conservative and one would say looking toward the past, and the other much more cosmopolitan, open to the new ideas of the 18th century, and eager to see that an enlightened form of justice is achieved.
We need to wrap up, but I do have one kind of last question, and it's fascinating how you have all this, you know, from the local to the transatlantic, figuring into this sort of spaghetti of, personal and very political history. What I'm wondering is, you mentioned that it would be pretty hard to write the story of these two guys and, you know, just tell their stories and leave it, right? So by themselves, they're quirky cases and they're interesting, but if you don't dig more deeply, you don't have much of a story. The political history that you unravel and the religious history that you unravel, I think, is so fascinating. Would the political and the religious history be as good if you didn't go into these personal histories? In other words, you know, we can see how the personal history needs the political and the religious history. Do the political and the religious histories need the personal histories?
Well, what I would argue, and Daron may have some different ideas, thoughts about it, but what I would argue is that it's important always in our own time and in past times to appreciate how grand decisions at the macro level affect individual lives and the experience of people at the grassroots in very particular and frequently life and death ways. So the Supreme Court makes a decision, whether the United States Supreme Court or the Connecticut Supreme Court. The legislature enacts a law. A judicial system operates. It has its principles. It has prescriptions as to how it's supposed to operate. But I think it's very, very important for people to understand the particularities of how it really does operate. What really are the consequences for people if this law is on the books or that law is on the books? Under what circumstances does the law come down hard on people? Under what circumstances does the law play a more relaxed, permissive role? And I don't think that you can really understand and appreciate those characteristics of present or past unless you grapple with individual cases.
And I would add to that, you know, that, that it's appropriate that you ask this question because the great virtue of this kind of a book is that...
It has a great virtue. I'm glad to hear that.
The great virtue of this kind of a book of microhistory. This book may not have that many great virtues, but I hope so. Is the fact that it provides this kind of look into the tensions in society, but it's not on the abstract level. It's experience as it affects individual human beings, and this has been this has always been the challenge of historians. You know, when you walk into a classroom and someone tells you, you know, the undergraduates tell you, well, you know, tell me really what happened. I want to know what happened, and sort of, so you could say, oh, there was industrialization. Okay, and you finish teaching all the history. Well, it's not really it. I mean, and really, what by moving between the individual and the particular on the one hand, and the broader social, religious, political, cultural developments, you get a more in-depth understanding of those big picture issues as well as. How individuals respond to them.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. I just want to say that I found this such a fascinating book on, as we mentioned, law, the justice system, sexuality, politics, religion. You really got it all in here. And I'm sure our listeners will want to get their copy of Taming Lust, Crimes Against Nature in the Early Republic from the University of Pennsylvania.
I hope they get more than one copy.
Thank you so much.